It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. I grew up in this city, and a big part of the coming-of-age experience as a teenager in the 70s and 80s and beyond here in the Steel City was going to rock concerts. And if you are of a certain age, chances are those rock shows here in town were shows you attended at the Civic Arena, the Syria Mosque, and the Stanley Theater way back when. And they were promoted by Pat DeCesar and Rich Engler, better known simply as DeCesar Engler. DeCesar Engler brought in everyone from Paul McCartney to Madonna to even Sammy Davis Jr. And Rich Engler has accumulated so many backstage stories over the years that he decided to put them into a book called Behind the Stage Door. He joins us now in Studio A to share some stories with us. Rich Engler, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Wow, thank you very much. So glad to be here with you.
So how many times have people said to you over the years, Rich, you really ought to write a book?
So many times. That's what motivated me to really do it. I'd be in a crowd of people and they'd say, Rich, tell us a story. Tell us a story. But a good one, backstage especially. Everybody wanted to know about backstage. Well, I tell them, 90% of the time it's boring, but it's that 10% that'll jump out at you like, really? So I finally decided 3 years ago to reduce all my memories and the good, bad, and the ugly into writing, and there we go.
Let's look at some numbers here. How many rock shows would you say that you've produced over the course of a 40-year career? Rough guesstimate.
I was trying to figure that out. I think it's around 5,000.
5,000 shows. Now, you grew up in this area. What part of western Pennsylvania did you grow
up? Up the Allegheny River, little town called Creighton, between Springdale and Trentham. And it was about 2 miles long, and Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company took up about a mile of it back when.
Did you know then, as a kid, that you wanted to work in rock and roll back then? We're talking early 60s, right?
Yeah. 63. I had my first opportunity. A friend of mine wanted to start a combo. There weren't even bands yet because the Beatles weren't out yet. So I said, yeah, I'd love to join something like that. And he said, we have a gig coming up. We're going to be making $100. You get $25. And I go, wow, because minimum wage was a dollar. I thought, this what a way to make a living if I could ever do this. And I was already planning to go to college and whatever, so I had to make a few decisions along the way. And we played that gig, and nobody threw anything at us. And I thought, I got home, and my parents said, they actually paid you for playing? I said, yeah, look. I said, but I need to get a real drum set. I had some makeshift drum set that I created on my own, and my parents loaned me $75, and I bought a drum set. And then I go to my buddy that had the band. I said, well, when do we play next? He goes, well, I'm trying to find gigs. And then he goes on for about two or three weeks without any work. I said, hey, I have to pay my parents back. You're no longer the leader. I got to be the leader of this band. I'll find us engagements. So I went out there, did something that I never knew what to do or how to do it, and I was able to create deals and get into clubs, colleges, fraternities, anything that we could play. And bingo, we started to get famous.
So you were honing your skills not only as a musician but as a promoter as well, and eventually you were part of a well-known local band called Grains of Sand. And you got to open up for some pretty big names in the music business.
Indeed. We opened up for the Yardbirds down at Hunt Armory with Jimmy Page there and the band.
Hunt Armory. Wow.
Wow. Yeah. It still exists.
Right across from Sacred Heart School.
Exactly. And probably one of the biggest thrills back then is band The Beach Boys with the original band, Carl and Brian and Dennis, they were all there, and Good Vibrations had just come out, and it ran straight to the top of the charts, and we were setting up, and I was there, and I see this thing that looked like a board with a coat hanger sticking out of it, and I'm kind of looking at it, and out of the blue, Mike Love yells, hey, get away from that, and he comes running on the stage, and this was in rehearsal in the afternoon, and here it was the theremin. And I said, what the heck is this thing? He says, you know, that in the middle of Good Vibration, goes, woo, because it was before the Moog synthesizer was out. And nobody had ever heard these kind of noises. So he kind of showed us how to play it. Kind of cool.
Neat. So how did you then end up going from rock musician to rock promoter?
Well, from rock musician, my band got really, really famous up in Canada and all these different places. And so I'd call, people would call me for my band, and I'd say, well, we're already booked, but I have Paul and the Hornets. Do you want them? I said, they're the same money. And they go, sure, how much? I said, well, $500 or $1,000. So I'd call you and say, hey, Paul, I got your band a booking. You're going to pay me 10%. Is that good? Yes. So I then had about 20 Paul and the Hornets under me. And one day the music union called me and said, hey, what are you doing booking all these acts like this? I said, these are my friends. They go, no, no, no. You have a business, so you have to have a license doing that. I said, okay, where do I'll get a license. So I ended up getting a license in 1969. And bingo, I opened an office on Walnut Street and Shadyside called Go Attractions with another associate of mine, Paul St. John at the time. And then I was still booking these local acts. And then I decided I wanted to book national acts. All these acts like Santana, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Johnny Winter, all these acts were new acts and relatively inexpensive. So I'd call New York and L.A. to these agents who didn't really know who I was. But I said, hey, I think I can get your band $5,000 at like St. Bonaventure University in New York. They said, well, okay, book it. So I'd call. Instead of making hundreds of dollars, I started to make thousands of dollars because I went and produced the show also for the schools, and I honed my skills as how to be a promoter. I didn't really realize it that much at the time, and then I started putting my own money down and investing and selling then to the public.
And that's when you're really in the business. We're talking with Rich Engler, the author of Behind the Stage Door, about his 40 years as a rock promoter. And for a while, you were a working musician as well as a promoter, but eventually there was an incident that forced you to make a choice. What happened?
Oh, man. That's so vivid in my mind. I was able to buy the group and promote the group, Yes, at Gannon College in Erie, Pennsylvania. They Red Hot, number one songs. And so I told the agent in New York that there's a Red Hot opening act also in the Pittsburgh area, the Grains of Sand, not telling this person in New York that I deal with all the time that it was my band. So the evening comes. I'm there. I'm on stage. I'm playing. Everything's great. The show is sold out. I'm playing drums. Next thing I see out of the right side of my eye, peripheral, is the band coming in, going into the dressing room. All of a sudden, a real big guy with a tanuki fur coat comes, and he's talking to the security guard over there, and a lot of hand gestures and everything. And next thing I see is the security guard point at me on stage. And I go, I see, and I go, uh-oh. And this guy looks like he's furious. So I tell my band, I kind of signal, we better, this is the last song. So we end, I'm all sweated up with and have a towel around my head. I run over there. I had the balance check for him because the show was sold out. Knock at the door. He comes out. He goes, are you the promoter? I go, yeah, hello, I'm Rich Engler. He goes, I'm Brian Lane. I'm the promoter. And he's reeking of booze and foul language. And he goes, listen, I want to tell you, blankety, 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 you better be at this door. Anytime you have any of my acts or any of my European acts come over here, I want your full attention. I said, I'm sorry, sir. I said, here you go. Here's your check. Let's have a good show. Great. He slams the door in my face. So I think it goes away. Next day, I get a call from New York. They said, hey, Barbara, her name Barbara Skydell, she calls me. She goes, Rich, she goes, laughingly, she goes, you'll never believe this. You know, Brian Lane, he always has crazy stories, and I never know what to believe or not. She said, he tried to tell me that you were in the opening act. Can you believe it? And I was like, silence. I go, well, I was. She said, seriously? She said, I want to drive down there and strangle you. You cannot do that. You have to decide right now, or I'm never dealing with you again, which side of the stage you want to be on. You want to either be on the stage or behind the stage. I said, I made my decision. I'll be behind the stage and never played again since.
So you were, and then at that point, you end up teaming up with legendary promoter Pat DeCesar to form this team of DeCesar Engler. And you brought in some big, big names. And in the 70s and 80s, rock musicians were doing a lot of drugs. Did that lead to any difficulties when it came to getting performers up on stage?
Oh, yes. The one that sticks out, it's one of the chairman of the board, actually, Eric Clapton. Great show, great showman, great guitar player. And in 1975, Three River Stadium, July 5th, I had the group The Band with Garth Hudson and the whole crew and Todd Rundgren and some others. And it was time for Clapton to go on, and Clapton wanted to talk to me backstage. So I get back in there, and he's embedded into this couch. And I'm talking to him, small talking, and I can see he didn't seem like he was in the best condition. But he was talking and we're carrying on, and I said, "Well, what do you think? You think we can have a show?" He goes, "Well, no hurry." And I said, "So I hear the crowd out there, Eric, Eric, Eric," and the lighters and everything going. So I'm trying to speed up the whole process, and I said, "Well," I said, he goes, "You know, it's my birthday," somewhere along the line. I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, if I have a party for you after, will you come to the party?" He goes, hopefully. So I said, okay. So we're going. I said, come on, let's have a show. So I could see that he wasn't getting up. So I beckoned to a couple of his road guys and manager there, tour manager, and they get him under the shoulders, and they get him out of the couch, and we head then for the stage, and we're going down through the tunnel just like the Steelers used to come out onto the field at Three River Stadium. And I remember there are like 11 steps to the top of the stage, and I'm thinking, oh no, this is not going to be easy. So we get to the stage, and they kind of halt. They still kind of have a hold of them. And so another guy comes and helps with the feet a little bit to make sure he doesn't stumble. We get him up to the top, and I thought, I'm just praying, please play. So the announcer runs out. He yells, "Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for Eric Clapton." They strap the guitar on him. They push him out, and he cooked. I just couldn't believe it.
He somehow was able to manage.
He showed up. I didn't watch a second of it because I was so nervous that he was not going to get through the show, because in 1975, a big failure like that would have been devastating. To give back all the money I think there were about 45,000 people there that night, so it was big. So later on, he comes. We're all at the party. It's right outside the Liberty Tubes. I rent this dive because we didn't want anybody other than the invitees there. So there was people from his band and some of the band, and we were having a good time. But no Clapton. So the party's starting to wind down. People were leaving. All of a sudden, boom! The doors go flying open, and it's Eric. He kind of shuffles around back and forth, and I come over. "Hey, Eric, I'm glad you made it." He goes, "Where's me blanking kike?" I said, "Oh, your cake. Yes, it's right over here. Come on over here." So he comes over to the cake. He looks down at it, and he goes, oh. So he picks it up and puts it under his hand, like waiter style, and he bolts toward the door. And before he smashes out through the door, he turns around and goes, "Toodaloo," and slams the door, and he's gone, jumps in a limo with the cake.
Just one of the many rock and roll backstage.
That's right. So needless to say, the party was over.
Yeah, I guess so. has the concert business changed over the years?
Oh, big time, big time. In the early days, whenever I first started, even before DeCesar Engler, I had a burning desire to send the message of the music. This was our music. This was our generation. We had a message to send out to people. It wasn't about the money. It would be nice to make money, but it was first and foremost music. Get the message across. Then, as time grew, productions grew, ticket prices grew, artist guarantees grew, consolidation of all these villages of DeCesar Englers around the country, the consolidation, business started to overshadow the music.
Rich Engler is a longtime Pittsburgh concert promoter and author of the book Behind the Stage Door. So many stories that we weren't able to get to, but you'll find them in the book. And Rich Engler, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Well,
we
great.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, great. You can get the book at most select Giant Eagle stores, Pittsburgh Guitars, right here, right by your studio down here on the south side.
Yep.
And select Crazy Mochas and richengler.com. You can send out, and I autograph each one from richengler.com.
Behind the Stage Door by Rich Engler. He's been our guest. Again, Rich, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Glad to be here, and it was fun.
And thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Steve Sokol and Kevin Gavin will be filling in for me tomorrow and Friday. I'll be away from the host chair until after the holidays. In the meantime, we'll have some special holiday programs, as well as several Best of Essential Pittsburgh shows in which we revisit some of our favorite interviews and stories from the past year. Until 2014, I'm Paul Guggenheimer saying, as always, thanks for listening.